Well, or that was the foxhole one.
That was the foxhole one.
This amateur radio roundtable is brought to you in part by ICOM America. All right, welcome everybody to Amateur Radio Roundtable. I'm Tom Medlin, W5KUB, and this is August the 25th. And another month's almost over with. Can't believe it. Anyway, this is a ham radio show. If you're listening out there in international shortwave on 5130 kilohertz on WBCQ, out of Monticello, Maine, we welcome you. It's a ham radio show. If you want to learn about ham radio, stick around, listen. Or if you have internet access, you can actually go to and watch the show on the internet. Just go to w5kub.com, and you can watch the show. Click on video, and you'll see us. Send us an email to tom@w5kub.com. We'd love to hear from you. Wherever you are in the world, send us a note. Tell us how you're receiving the station. Up there. The 40-meter net tonight was just pretty bad. We had about 6 or 7 check-ins, and the band condition just seemed really bad tonight. But don't forget about it next week. We'll be back 5:30 Central Time on 7180. Just wondering, do we have anybody new in the chat room? I'm looking at the chat room here. If you're new to the show, say hi to us in the chat room. We'd love to hear from you. And I need to start showing these. I get some cards every day or two. I've been just returning cards, and I've been filing these. But hey, here's one from I got this week or last week. AI-9R, Thomas Moore, nice B-20. What's that, B-29, I think. Yeah, B-29 picture right there. That's Thomas's QSL card. Here's a nice one from Jeff. KE9BV from Kansas. That's a cool looking card he's got there from Kansas. Nice glossy color. So we'll put these with our collection of other cards. Got a lot of cards now. I'll try to start showing those each week if you guys send me some cards in. Katie's out tonight. She's going to be out probably for a couple weeks. But she will be back. Don't worry. Let's see what else is going on. We've got tonight, we've got Rich with us from CQ. We've got Joe with us. I think he has some kits that he might show us, and he's got a special secret that he's going to talk to us about tonight. I don't think anybody else in the world has one of these. I don't know. And then we got Glenn Popiel on here. I don't know what he's got. We'll find out when we talk with him there. And, of course, we got Bill Brown here. We'll talk a little about the balloon tonight. I saw a comment in the chat room about an obsession with balloons, so if you don't like balloons, you might not want to be here tonight, because we will touch on them. Anyway, we welcome everybody out there, man. Thanks for joining us tonight. And let's just check and see. Let's go around the room here, and let's just check with Glenn first. It looks like he's going to pop up first. Hey, Glenn, how you doing, man?
Oh, hanging in there. Just busting my butt on the next book.
Yeah, so how's it going?
Well, not too bad. I've got one of the other projects. I mean, the LED ring that I showed last week, I finally got it working with the CDE rotor and the ASU rotor, so I'm just about ready to box that up if the Postal Service will ever cooperate. Apparently, they want some more money because my mail has now been bouncing between South Haven, between Memphis and Oxford, Mississippi, like 3 times now, and they just can't figure out that South Haven's kind of in the middle there. Drop my stuff off.
All right. Well, so you're a busy guy now, man, with all this stuff going on. I mean,
oh yeah. and school starting again, so
yeah,
I'm going to be back doing that. You know, it's going to be a strange school year this year.
Well, we need to get. Well, I was going to say we need to get together sometime again, but you know, with all this COVID stuff, you probably don't want to come. Let me rephrase that. I don't want you in the studio with me.
Ouch!
How's that, man?
I take showers and brush my teeth and everything.
Yeah. All right. We'll we'll get together soon, man, and we'll do something here. Let's jump over to Bill. Let's see if we can get Bill Brown in here. We had a little connection problem with him earlier. How you doing tonight, Bill?
I'm doing good. Been working on a little project this evening to add two more characters to my make a 10-digit grid square.
Oh,
and
man.
And you can actually get down to 60 feet by 100 feet resolution if you can do that.
Yeah, well, that would be kind of cool. Now, are you going to have it ready for this next flight?
Yes, I'm testing it right now.
So, okay.
All it does is add two more characters to your JT9 transmission.
Okay.
You send your call sign and a 6-digit grid in the first JT9 transmission. That's after your whisper transmission. And then the second JT9 field, there are only more transmissions.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that a little. I think you're freezing just a little. We'll talk a little more about that a little later in the show tonight. Let's jump around to, let's just go ahead and bring in our monthly regular wait a minute. I forgot Joe. Joe, talk to us, man. Now, don't talk about Kitch yet, but you've got some secret something there, and tell us about it, man.
Now, wait a minute. If he tells us about it, he's going to have to shoot us afterward.
That's right. But this is kind of cool, man.
Okay, as you can see over my shoulder, as I rearrange some of the awards and stuff, there's a new...
Your audio is a little low. Can you talk a little louder?
Okay, let me turn the gain up.
How's that? Well, okay. I don't...
I had the gain at...
That's better.
Low. The clock just above my head there, the Zulu clock, is not new, but it's new to my shack over the last couple days. And... I can see you zooming in on it.
Yeah, I moved the clock where they can see it.
Okay. If any of you have ever seen these movies where they show the resemblance of the command center for global nuclear war, that command center actually used to be called the Strategic Air Command in Omaha and later became STRATCOM. And they moved STRATCOM last November to a new building not far away to replace the old one that was built in the Cold War days of the 1950s. And so they're in a nice new building, and a friend of mine is a technician, and he was decommissioning stuff out of the old building and came across this clock in a pile of stuff marked D-class, and so it's declassified and for disposal. And when he looked at it, he says, oh, I know somebody who'd probably like to have that on his wall. And so he gifted that to me a few days ago. And I've discovered that a little bit about its history, and called the clock manufacturer, who gave me a lot of information and a manual how to wire it up so I can sync the clock, which will be, as Glenn and I have been talking about, we're conspiring to make a Arduino-based interface to set the clock so it stays on the right seconds. This particular clock, when it was in use, they used three of its modes. It has a lot more modes than that, but the three modes they used was the Zulu clock, and then a count-up clock that would count to a certain point before it alarmed, and a count-down clock. And either one of those last two functions, I don't think you want to be around if those functions were used, because that was the timing for incoming and outgoing from the nuclear command. So what I actually have on the wall was, for about 10 years, the actual doomsday clock of the world, right there.
Wow.
From our global nuclear forces. And so it's interesting. I've got it going, and I have information from the manufacturer in Kansas. And the guy, when I called him, surprisingly, was a ham, the technical support guy, and was really, really helpful. And so that will be kind of a conversation piece. Everybody say, you know, is it counting down, you know? And I think, as we discussed, at least Glenn and I, there is a way to send serial codes in this one data frame slot to put it into that countdown mode. So maybe we're going to worry if that thing switches from Zulu to incoming.
Well, you've got a piece of history there. So,
yes, it is.
You know, it's amazing. It's still working after all these years.
Yeah, it's still running.
All right. Well, very good. And we're going to talk later. You got a few kits you're going to show us or anything?
Yep,
anything
I've
new?
I've got three kits I'll
okay.
be showing you.
All right, great. Well, we'll get those in a minute. Let's go out to Rich Moison, W2VU, out in New Jersey, I think. Rich, you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, how you doing tonight, man?
Doing great. And looking forward to tomorrow's weather, which is supposed to be a lot cooler than today's. It was up in the low 90s here today. Fortunately, the humidity had dropped off, though, so it wasn't real bad. It's supposed to be very nice tomorrow, though.
It was even hot here today. Even though a cool front's come through, I took a quick one-mile walk this afternoon before the show, and it was still hot out there. Man.
I guess you and I both need to be watching out for the remnants of Laura. Looking at the last tracking map, it looks like it's coming straight up to you guys and then making a sharp right and coming up to the northeast. So.
Yeah, it's predicted to come right kind of through here, so we'll just batten down the hatches. I imagine we'll get 10 to 20 mile an hour winds, but probably a lot of rain.
I don't know what's left of it when it gets up here, but New Jersey's right in the middle of the cone at the moment, so see what happens.
Well, hey, Rich, let's while we got you on here, let's talk about CQ Magazine, man. What's coming next month?
Oh, we got all sorts of great stuff coming for September. We've got start out with a story called Signals from Down Under by VK4QS, one of our regular contributors. He's writing about the DX possibilities of the Oceana DX contest, which is going to be in October. So you have some time to get ready for it and tune up your antennas for pointing either up or down, depending on whether you want to work short path or long path to the South Pacific. And as with many contests like state CUSO parties here in the U.S., with a lot of rare counties getting on the air, a lot of rare countries get on the air during the Oceana DX contest, countries down in the Oceana region that may not frequently be on the air. So it's a good time to opportunity to snag them and to maybe pick up a few new countries or banned countries. Mm-hmm. We've also got the results of our WPX single sideband contest, which was in the spring, and huge jump in participation in that. And that's primarily, we think, due to so many people being home because of the coronavirus shutdowns and everything else. So hams, of course, well-known for making the best of whatever situation they're in. So there are a lot of hams, more hams on the air during the WPX contest than usual. And we also have another article on dealing with making the most of the pandemic. KL4E up in Alaska was at a conference in Florida just before all the shutdowns happened, and when he got home to Alaska, he had a quarantine for 2 weeks along with his wife and his daughter who had been on the trip with him. So they used the time to build antennas and get them up. He's wrote an article on that. It's they're all mounted on the deck of his house with some great mountains in the background. And one of the really cool features is that he has a manual control for turning the beams that is based on some ropes that he passes through the bulkhead where the coax goes, and he's got a big pulley on it, and he's able to use the ropes to turn the antenna, so he doesn't need an actual rotor.
That's cool.
It's really cool. Our classic this month is very interesting, too. 50 years ago, this past September, there was a big story in the news about civil war going on in Jordan and it being cut off from most normal communications. And the only contact out of Jordan for a good couple of weeks was by the king, JY1, with a teenage Tam in England, Rory Margolis, G3UML. And his mother, who was a regular contributor to CQ back in the 60s and 70s, wrote an article about it at the time. And this is our classic for this month. And Laurie has followed up with kind of an update article called JY1 50 Years On, about how that experience has stayed with him through a long career as a BBC journalist. So being in the news got him interested in reporting the news, and has had a great career there. A couple of project articles this month. We have an old school digital counter and digital dial. This is what do you do with a bunch of vintage parts? Build something to go to the vintage radio. Huh. So KC0ZNG, Bryant Jostrom, turned some old LEDs into a frequency counter and display for an old receiver using period-appropriate circuitry. So that's really a lot of fun, especially for folks who are into vintage gear. Should be a fun project. For our shortwave listeners out there, hello, shortwave listeners, we've got two goodies this month. We have a review of the Eaton Elite 750 shortwave receiver. Very, very cool piece of equipment. It's kind of an update on the Grundig 750 with a lot of new features and things like that. And then, of course, our monthly listening post column has its usual loggings, reports of different stations. And the focus this month is the sad decline of Russia's shortwave broadcasters and the mystery of Brazil's declining logs. So you got to read that to stay up on that. Joe's column this month is titled Phasers Set on Stunned, for all of you Star Wars fans. I'm sorry, Star Trek fans. And he talks about building the phaser transceiver, which we had a review, full review last month. And Joe shares his experiences in building it and getting it on the air this month. It's a really cool kit. I don't know if that's one of the kits he's planning to talk about tonight. He'll have to tell you that later. Our microcontrollers column features the legend of the Headless Horseman, appropriate as we approach Halloween. So we'll find out what Anthony is writing about there. And in digital connection, we have Deviation and the Dongle, which requires no explanation, right? Well,
I don't know.
Maybe it does. So you got to read the article.
Yeah.
Our awards column this month is on the CW focused awards. And our contesting column refers back to what we were talking about with the CQWPX contest results, the spike in on-air activity and contesting due to COVID-19. And finally, our propagation column is about renewed solar activity promising improved DX this autumn. So we're definitely looking forward to that. We are absolutely starting the upward crawl of cycle 25. And depending on whose report you're listening to, you're either going to have another cycle like 24, which was not that exciting, or one of the best of all time. We've got some details on that report as well in our News Bites column this month. I'll look at that very sunny prediction for cycle 25 to go along with the very cloudy one. That's the common wisdom one. So that's a basic wrap-up of what's coming up in September CQ. Our Summer Madness special is still going on. If anyone's interested in signing up for a subscription, either digital around the world or print here in the U.S., and just go to our website at www.cq-amateur-radio.com and look at all the different options that you have there. Basically, it's one free issue for every year that you order. So you get 13 issues instead of 12. If you get 1 year, 26 issues instead of 24 for a two-year subscription, and 39 issues instead of 36 for a three-year subscription. And that's a look at September. We're wrapping up our calendar for 2021-22. It's always one of my more enjoyable summer projects is working on that. And we're basically nailing that down right now. And some other goodies that we're working on, some books and things like that, which you'll be hearing more about over the next couple of months.
Well, Rich, you mentioned shortwave a few minutes ago. I guess it's really hard to tell how well shortwave is really doing nowadays. I mean, it's hard to get numbers. Do you guys have any feel for that?
It's kind of a two-edged sword right now.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, more and more government-focused international broadcasters are moving off of shortwave.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for those of us who grew up in the heyday of shortwave, where you could tune in Radio Moscow or BBC or Deutsche Welle, wherever you tuned on the dial, and you know, kind of search between them for the smaller stations, a lot of those are gone. And it's really too bad because, you know, there are many parts of the world where it's not easy to get reliable internet signals, particularly streaming audio. And radio works, and it gets into every corner of the world. A little simple shortwave receiver doesn't mm-hmm. require a connection to the internet. So I've always thought that it's very short-sighted to be pulling the plug on the radio transmitters. At the same time, the loss of some of the bigger signals creates greater opportunities for shortwave DXers to tune in some of the smaller stations. There are many of them still out there. And to, you know, get some of the weaker signals and lower powered stations and be able to tune them in. There's still quite a bit of drama. You know, you have opposition stations, you have people trying to jam them, you've got pirates, you've got all sorts of cool stuff still out there on the shortwave bands. There's plenty to listen to and a greater opportunity for tuning in some of the stations that might have been very difficult to get back in the days when there were lots and lots of strong signals on the air from major broadcasters. So it's sad to see some of the major broadcasters go, but at the same time, it opens up new opportunities for shortwave DX.
Yeah, I've noticed there are a number of shortwave Facebook groups. It's still a good hobby, and people are involved in it. Of course, that's where many of us got our start for ham radio, you know, listening to shortwave. And hope it doesn't go away. And like you'd mentioned the pirate stations. There's probably a lot of pirate stations out there.
Yeah, we've got a pretty long listing in our loggings this month. You know, every month we have a listening post column by Jerry Dexter. And in addition to news about shortwave broadcasters, he shares loggings from a variety of people, whoever, you know, sends them in, of stuff that they got. We've got a pretty long listing of pirate stations. It's always interesting to listen to, as well as stations in conflict zones on both sides of issues. Excuse me. And
well, I can, you know, hey, back in the early days, you probably remember this, man. I mean, the main ones, you had Radio Moscow, you had Havana, Cuba, mm-hmm. you had Quito, Ecuador, of course, Voice of America.
CKB. Yeah, well, Voice of America is still there, and
yeah.
Radio Havana is still there.
Well, okay, hey, thanks so much for giving us the insight to next month, and looking forward to getting the magazine. Stick around with us and join the rest of the show if you feel like it, or if you need to leave at any point. We'll see you next month.
All righty. It's always great to be here and share what's coming up in the next issue of CQ. I will stick around for a little while.
Okay.
And, all right. Then probably just quietly disappear.
Okay, cool. All right, guys. That was Rich, W2VU. He's the editor of CQ Magazine. All right, we'll be back in just a second here. Get out and be active with ICOM's new IC705 and its optional multifunction backpack. The IC705 is your perfect QRP rig, as you have base station features at the tip of your fingers in a portable package covering HF, 6 meters, 2 meters, and 70 centimeters. This compact rig weighs in at just over 2 pounds with RF direct sampling for most of the HF bands, and IF sampling for frequencies above 25 megahertz. And it has a large 4.3-inch color touchscreen with a live band scope and waterfall. Additional features include 5 watts with the BP272, 10 watts with 13.8 volts, SSB, CW, AM, FM, as well as D-Star. It has a micro USB connector and Bluetooth, integrated GPS with antenna and GPS logger. It has a micro SD card slot. The HM243 speaker mic comes standard, and it supports QRP operations. The perfect accessory is the optional backpack. It's the LC192. It has a special compartment for your IC705. Visit www.icomamerica.com/amateur for more information on ICOM radios. And don't forget, you should register for QSO Today's groundbreaking virtual ham expo.
LBG Electronics provides state-of-the-art antenna tuners for every amateur need. From QRP to QRO, fixed stations, portable and remote, an LDG tuner will match your radio to your antenna using our lightning-fast proprietary tuning algorithms. LDG is a family-owned and operated company dedicated to bringing innovative, quality products to the amateur market. All LDG products carry a full 2-year warranty that is fully transferable. Support is only a phone call or email away. We're always here to help you. Visit us on the web at ldgelectronics.com.
All right, and we are back. Let me turn the echo off here. All right, well, hey, man, when Joe showed us that neat little clock he got from the government, I wondered, the government give stuff like that away? Aren't I part owner of that clock? What do you think, Glenn?
Yeah, but you only get the countdown part.
I get the countdown part, huh? Okay. All right. Well, hey, Joe, come on in here, Joe, and let's talk about some new kits that you might have there for us.
All right. And let me see here and see if it lets me share my screen this time. Let's see if it does that. Nope, it's not letting me because you didn't let me, Tom.
Oh, do I need to do that again? All right.
Yeah, you have to do it every time.
I'm getting pretty good at this. I'm getting pretty good. I forgot. Let's see. Maybe I do it right here. Here we go. Oh.
There you go.
Yeah, I think I did it right. Oh, boy.
Okay, so
can
now
you do it?
I get to share my screen. Let's see if I can get some photos up.
Yeah, your audio is still just a little low, Joe, so you either talk
okay.
louder or crank it up a little bit.
I've got it turned up a lot more.
Okay.
Now.
Okay.
How's that?
That's a lot better.
Okay. So let's make this bigger. Now you can see it, okay?
Yeah, let me hang on a second. Hang on. For some reason, There it comes. It just now came into the broadcast. Okay, there you go. And I'm going to try to adjust the size a little bit.
Okay.
Of it. There we go.
What we're looking at are the parts that are involved in the North Fulton Amateur Radio League Code Practice Kit. Now, NFARL is a club in the Atlanta area near Marietta, Georgia, which is the north side of Atlanta. And if you look, this is all the parts that are there, and you can start counting them. There's two battery holders, a transistor, a piezo speaker, two resistors, a touchpad, which actually has some surface mount parts underneath it, but they're already done, a three-pin connector for that, a switch, an LED, and a jack. So you don't have a lot of parts here. And that's because this is designed for first-time kit builders. Hmm. And, you know, we always kind of joke that a code practice oscillator is usually people's first kit, but actually it's kind of a good idea. Gets them to get a chance to learn a little CW. And mostly, if it does anything, it gives you experience building something. And Glenn will attest to this as well. If you get somebody to build a kit, and it works, then they're going to go and they're going to try and build another one and another one until they get into more advanced kits. And that's what we want in amateur radio. We want people to build kits. As you can see, the curvature of the circuit board means what? It's designed for Altoids tins, just like a lot of the QRPME kits and other kits. They are designed to fit the ubiquitous Altoids tin. This one runs on two coin cell batteries, which are the same kind of batteries you use in your, like, your car remotes, some of the TV remotes, things like that. So let's take a look here at what I did to the tin. You can see I drilled a hole in the left, and that's for the input jack. So you can plug an external key into it. And then I have these threaded standoffs that are screwed in from the bottom. There's a screw underneath them that holds it in. And then these things hold it up about a quarter of an inch or so above the bottom of the tin. So it actually fits just perfectly in there. And then what happens when you put it all together? Well, this is what it looks like close up. It uses a single 2N7000, which is a MOSFET that's very commonly used as a final output, RF output, in a lot of QRP radios. They use mm-hmm. one, two, or three of them in parallel. So it's a kind of a rugged little transistor for being just a little case like that. There's actually two LEDs in this thing. The touch module has a surface mount red LED that lights up the bottom of that switch when you touch it. And there's an LED on the right, a real, real bright blue one that lights up. And there's a power on-off switch so that you don't, of course, drain your batteries. And like I said, there's two resistors. This is perfect for a one-hour group kit build because it won't take people that long to put these together. And, of course, you don't. If you're going to have them putting them in the tins, then you should probably have those already pre-drilled and set up for them to save time. Because drilling Altoids tins is not very easy. You got to be really careful because it's very thin. But it's not a bad kit. In fact, when I'm done showing my pictures, I'll hold one up and show you how it works. But what I've also done is I've hooked it up like this. You can see a little miniature CW key I have there, and it plugs into there on the left side of the kit, and it blinks the light. Now, one thing that I noticed is that I use a metal cookie sheet for when I'm building my kits. Well, I've discovered that the touch module on this, which is a capacitive touch module, gets really affected by the metal cookie sheet that was underneath the metal Altoids tin that was in contact with it. But as soon as I took it off the cookie sheet, everything seemed to work normal. So kind of remember that. If you're working with this kit on a metal surface, you might want to lift it off afterwards. So I spent most of the whole article for October talking about this, because everybody is always asking me for kits that they can do with the group that don't take that long to build and are relatively easy to put together, and this one pretty much fills the bill.
Hey, there's a question in a chat room about the little standoffs. Does all that come with the kit?
No. I just happen to have those.
Gotcha.
Back when Mendelssohn's used to have a thing there with a grocery scale that you could buy.
Buy it by the pound.
Buy by the pound. I used to do that. I would pretty much fill my suitcase with buy-by-the-pound hardware and then sort it out at home afterwards, and I have a good collection now. It's too bad that they're closed up. This next kit here, called the Morse Arino, is an Arduino-based Morse code practice set. Now, this one will remind you more of the four-state kits that have a lot of surface mount parts that are already done for you. As you can see, all those parts that are on the board were already there. So you don't have to do any surface mount parts at all. It's all done, but all the through-hole parts, you're going to be putting those in. And there aren't that many. I think the thing that takes the most time to solder is the socket for the Nano, which also has a built-on OLED display. So we'll take a look at it. This is what it looks like when it's done. Now, the problem is that I was guilty of not following the directions completely, because when I tried to put the plastic case on the top that comes with it, I nicked a little corner of the display, and that pretty well wiped it out, so it doesn't work. It actually came on, but I couldn't control what mode it was in. So you have a knob here that you select things, and a push button that you select. It's kind of an interesting menu system, and you can upgrade the firmware through this port here, through the USB. So as long as you have the regular FTDI drivers that you would use to talk to an Arduino device or any other similar type of device, and Windows 10, I'm pretty sure, has that built in. You can use a USB cable and download the latest firmware and drivers and so on and upgrade this. So you can see it has the jacks, it has a power switch, it has a volume pot, input, output, and so forth. And then here's an external paddle jack, but there's also these plug-in PC board paddles, and these are touch paddles. They're not making contact. So just like the previous kit I showed, it just works on the touch when you actually touch the paddles. Now, if we look back here, you can see there's a nice size speaker. And this here, this little curly Q, is an antenna. And this particular little board also incorporates what's called LoRa, which is low radiation, in the 430 meg ham band. And it allows you to talk pretty low power, I don't know how many milliwatts, but it's not very much, to another similar unit that's in the same room, basically. You can go back and forth and send and receive Morse code back and forth wirelessly. But this board also has Wi-Fi, and you can actually, there's a way you can go through the internet and have somebody anywhere in the world who's on the internet, and I think you have to know each other's IP address, and this works. And so you're able to send and receive CW through the internet on this as well, or through Wi-Fi on a LAN. But the ability to send and receive code, it also decodes CW. It will do random code groups for you to practice. It'll decode what you're sending so that you can get your sending rhythm good enough that it looks right on the screen. Like I said, you can send and receive to another unit just like it in the room or through Wi-Fi or on the internet. This thing sells for about $100 in kit form, but like what I showed earlier, there's not a lot of parts. And so it doesn't take that long to put together. But I would say a little bit more advanced kit builder should do this only because of how close together the pins are on the sockets on the board. And I think that's the last of those pictures. And I'm going to, let's see. I don't know if this lets me quit sharing. For some reason, I'm not getting that particular command set back.
We have control. We have control over your computer.
Okay. But for some reason,
you can't click unshare?
Let me see here.
I'm not a Zoom expert, but
I don't know. I've never had to do this, so this is kind of disconcerting here.
Well, let's see if I can do something here. If I do that, does that bring you back?
Yeah, it all sure right. did.
I just blocked you from sharing. That's all I did. Yeah.
Okay, so now we got it back, and I have another kit to show, and then I'll go back to the other two again. This is a Tesla coil, and you can buy these for around $10 to $15 on any of the Chinese kit sites and so forth. And it's got a hair-thin wire that you can't hardly see.
A lot of turns,
comes out
yeah.
the top. You can see that hair-thin wire, and you can see kind of a corona off of the end of that when I run this. Obviously, I'm not going to run it right now. And it's got an audio input jack. You can take the audio from like an MP3 player or something.
Oh, yeah.
Feed it in, and you can hear it off the tip of that wire. You can also take an NE2 type neon bulb, which comes with the kit, and just hold the wires in your hand and get it within about 3 inches or so of this thing, and that bulb will light up from this. So it's kind of a miniature Tesla coil. It's a great way to teach about high voltage, and these are about $15.
Now, that voltage, you can actually touch that wire, couldn't you, where the spark is? I mean, isn't it so low that on many Tesla things I've seen, you can touch it.
Yeah, I don't think I'd touch the end of this because you can see blue flame kind of coming from it.
Well, try it for – hey, on a show next week, I want you to hook it up, and I want you to try to touch it on the show, okay?
Okay, now here's the Morse code kit again, and we'll – turn it on. And
oh, cool. We just lost Joe. Joe?
Did you lose me?
Yeah, now we got you back. You weren't talking, and you wasn't making enough noise.
Oh, yeah. I was doing the kit because you probably couldn't hear it.
Oh, yeah. That sounded like my smoke detector. If you hold it down. Yeah.
Yep. But anyways, there it is. It's not loud enough for the mic to pick it up because it was off the back of the PR40. And this is in the case. This is the Morserino, just waiting for a new display module for it. As you can see, there's a little hole there for the low raw coil there. And then you have this one for the Wi-Fi. And It's very unique, like I said, and that comes from Austria. So if you're ordering it, it's coming from Europe. So it might take 2 or 3 weeks to get it in the mail.
Yeah.
But like I said, I've never seen a code practice kit that does as much as this one does, including decoding your own code and decoding what it hears, like off the air or something, and the ability to communicate with another kit just like it, either through the LAN or the LoRa or Wi-Fi.
Yeah, hey, Joe, do you have a link or something for the Tesla coil? People are asking where they can get one.
Okay. I'll post one in the chat room.
Okay.
As soon as I'm done with this segment, I'll pull up a link for the Tesla kit. But it's very inexpensive and really easy to put together. I definitely recommend using heatsink grease on the two transistors because these heatsinks get really hot. That's what it's designed to do. The kit comes with a sheet in Chinese. And so, but if you Google it, the Tesla coil kit, there's a zillion English translations out there because a lot of other people have used these as teaching kits. So there are resources out there. Other than that, I will post a link in the chat room shortly for all these kits.
Okay, cool. Very good. All right. Thanks, Joe, for showing us those. You mentioned a little 2N7000, and Bill put me on this. You know, in the little 10-milliwatt tracker that we run, I'm always looking for more power, you know, kind of like Tool Man, you know, need more power. So I threw this together the other day and put it on there. This is a... this is this little breadboard of a 2N7002. It's only got about four parts on it. And this actually gives me about 10 dB of gain. So that should bring that. And when I hook it to the tracker, I can see the S meter on the receiver go up 10 dB when this amplifier is running. And But it weighs about, it could be less. Because I didn't use surface mount parts, I just used little discrete parts and wound my own coil and so forth.
That transistor is used quite commonly in a lot of kits because it's very, very efficient and surprising a lot of output for a little
it does.
MOSFET.
It does. I'm getting 10 dB. I'm going to fly it on some balloon in the future. I'm going to fly a 100-milliwatt balloon instead of a 10-milliwatt. Let's just see how far that gets at 40,000 feet, right?
That might be. Anyways, Tom, I will be glad to post the links in the chat.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, please do that. There's several questions there about it, and somebody might want to build one. You know, I was just thinking a minute ago. Rich was talking about shortwave, and I think he mentioned ABC News earlier. When I was overseas, I had a Korean call. My ham radio call was HL9KT, and I looked that up last week, and now it's been reassigned to an ABC News guy in South Korea. So I need to try to contact them and just say hi. You know, I used that call 50 years ago. That'd be kind of cool. Well, all right. Thanks, Joe. I don't know if we have anybody new in the chat room or not. If you're new in the chat room, we'd love to invite you to join our Facebook group. It's called W5KUB, just for the short address. It's actually called Amateur Radio Roundtable, but if you'll just put W5KUB in the search bar in Facebook, you will find our Facebook group, and we've got over 10,500 hams in that group now, and it's a good group. Just post anything you want to talk about ham radio. There's plenty of people to talk about that with you. Also, put your shack pictures in there, and Katie will be back soon, and we'll do some shack pictures. Be sure and give us a description of what's in the picture, so she won't have to make it up. Let's see what else is going on here. Oh, you know, for those following the Facebook group, I've been kind of on hold. I've been testing the new balloon, the new tracker for W5KB19, and I've been waiting on about a 5-cent part for a week, and it was a 4.3-volt regulator. They came in today, so I'll be able to package KUB19 up and get it ready for launch here soon. And we'll try to get that out. But we're not in any hurry right now because these hurricanes are causing some weather issues around. So we're going to kind of sit back and wait for, you know, some good weather before we launch this next one. And we'll try to go for more duration on this one. We will have a small battery on it in place of the Super Cap. And that should give us a little bit of extra coverage, particularly maybe in dark, or if it's coming down, it'll surely give us more coverage here. So let's bring Bill in. Now, Bill's been working on, in addition to the firmware that the last firmware we got from him to run on a tracker, Bill has now added JT9 in there, and he's getting the decimal point down really, really small on a JT9 transmission. So if this thing goes down now somewhere in a populated area, we're going to get latitude and longitude probably so accurate you're going to be able to walk right up to the balloon. So, hey, Bill, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good.
Well,
can you hear me okay?
I hear you. Let's see if I can bring you in here. There we go. Okay, so you're getting us down to how many decimal points? What are you doing?
Well, what I've done is the biggest, largest grid square that you can find online where you can decode it or encode it is six-digit grid square, which will get you to about a 3 by 5 mile area.
Now,
that's the six-digit grid square.
Okay, the six.
That's like
let's see, four, EM, five, six.
EM55D.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right.
For example, nearly.
And that's basically what we've been using. We've been using the six digit. Yeah, it gets it down to a 3 by 5 mile square. That's a pretty big area.
Right now, Edward YO3ICT, he came up with an 8-digit grid square. Which there are, if you search the internet, you can find information on how to do an 8-digit grid square, but there are very few websites that will decode it. If you put one in, or tell you what an 8-digit grid square is if you enter your latitude and longitude. But there are is information on how to do it. So he had that available. So I put that up on the JT9 transmission, and that gets you down to a 0.35-mile area. So today, in between breaks, between meetings and lunch and this evening and last night, I came up with a 10-digit grid square. And using the same pattern of how they did it for the previous, you know, the EM64 and the OJ, I now have 10 digits of grid square, which gets you down to a 60-foot by 110-foot box.
Now, that's getting down here. Now, is this some kind of off-the-wall thing, or is this kind of a standard out there in the industry?
No one does a 10-digit grid square, although there was some discussion on how you might go about it. So I just created a 10-digit grid square.
Well, what if I wanted to do a 12? Could I do a 12?
You probably could, but it wouldn't buy you a whole lot because now you're in the error range of a standard GPS. So you're pretty close to the error range anyways with a 10-digit, so it wouldn't buy you much of anything. So this is a way of getting a full latitude and longitude in 10 characters, which is really huge. So all I'm doing is sending your call sign, 6-digit grid JT9 transmission, which happens after your two whisper transmissions.
Yeah.
JT9's about 50 seconds long, and so the second one sends a 4-character field, which is the remainder of the last 4 digits of a 10-digit grid square. And then it will probably send your A to D count and the altitude. So I can share a screen here briefly and show you what I'm up to.
Okay.
If I
got to turn your share on.
block there.
There we go.
All right. So let's see if I can find my spreadsheet I was working on. And that's odd. I don't see my spreadsheet.
Maybe you took it down so low it self-destructed or something. I mean, you know.
Well, it's not giving me an option. Usually, okay, there's a spreadsheet there. Let me try that again. Ah, there it is. All right, can you see that?
Not yet. Now I do.
All right, so this is what I've been up to the last couple of days in my spare time, and between that and building PC boards. So you see this traditional EM64 on the bottom there. OJ, that's a six-digit grid square. My current location is EM64OJ28LC.
Wow.
So there's a 10-digit grid square for you. All the calculations are on the left there of how to do it. And if I change this field here and move that.
So Bill, let me ask you a question. So if people are monitoring JT9 and they pick this up, they'll get a kind of a coded message here, right? Just like that across the bottom.
What you're going to see is your call sign and then EM55DB for your house.
Yeah.
And then in the second field transmission on JT9, which will be just below the whisper band. And it's actually JT9 is only 3D less performance than Whisper, so a lot of people should be able to pick it up.
But when they see that number there, right now we have Python that in a spreadsheet that kind of converts stuff. But if they see that on JT9 right now, will they be able to read that without any additional spreadsheet or anything?
They can read the six digit, but
okay,
not the 10.
They can read the six. So
spreadsheet to decode it.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was wondering. So if anybody picks it up, and if we're going down or something, they should write that down and then contact us, right?
Right.
Yeah,
then
okay.
We'd be able to tell where the balloon has landed.
Yeah, okay.
Basically a 60-foot by 110-foot box. I just tested it. Walking the transmitter between one end of my house and the other, and it changed that last two digits.
Well, that's cool.
So,
now, I notice right now you don't have it set for any specific minimum or altitude or anything. You know, I originally thought let's turn it on if we're falling and we're below 2,000 or 5,000, but I don't guess it makes any difference. Leave it on all the time.
I can do that, but anyways, this is the pattern for a grid square is two letters, that's 24 characters, then followed by two digits that are 0 to 9, then it's followed, the fifth and sixth grid square are letters once again, 24 characters, followed by 0 to 10 for the numbers, and then the last two, I followed that same format of 0 to 24 letters. And that's how I got it down to such a small location.
But by somebody looking at that, they can actually tell down to what, the four-digit or six-digit?
Six-digit. You can decode that online.
Okay.
There are all kinds of resources. QRZ.com, they have something called GridMapper.
Okay.
And that's a real handy little tool, by the way. If you go to qrz.com/grid mapper, you can enter your latitude, longitude, or if you know your grid square.
Uh-huh.
And you can see who all's living within your 3x5 mile box, who's also a ham. And you can click on them and see their call signs.
That's cool. So, okay, so you're still improving the firmware, and right now I have your basic firmware down to the, what, 3/10 of a mile by a half a mile, I guess, or something like that. Yeah. So
for the JT9, it's now down to 60 by 100 feet.
How many feet down to 60?
This is my debug coming from the little tracker showing.
Okay.
Showing everything.
So,
and it's running right now,
our tracker transmits 2 minutes. It transmits 4 minutes out of 10. And with the JT9 going all the time, it's going to. How long is the JT9? Is it about a minute
for each one? So you'll be transmitting for 6 minutes and then off for four.
Okay, so we should have enough power. We should have power. Our power system's going to handle 240 milliamps, so we should be okay. That might shorten us a little bit in the dark, but that's okay. Yeah.
It really doesn't add a whole lot of current drain over and above just idle. It's maybe 8 milliamps more. During the transmission.
Yeah. Yeah, you're true. That's right. That's what I've noticed it. It's amazing how I can watch the current here on the meter, and when it goes to transmit, it's almost no different. And that's because you're turning off the GPS, I think, during transmission.
So G4JNT had a method for compressing latitude and longitude into, I believe, 12 characters. But this is a commonly available method of determining ham radio location, and I just figured, why not expand it?
Yeah. I just check and see if there's anything. I'll see if there's anything in the chat room we need to address there.
By the way, I wanted to mention that Carol Perry, 30 years ago, came up with a device like Joe showed that instead of Altoid tins, she had a PC board and a little push button and a battery and a beeper, a little buzzer, put into jewelry boxes. And it would snap open like a Star Trek communicator. And she taught her middle school students Morse code under the incentive that it was a secret language that none of their classmates would know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they learned Morse code, and they would carry these little communicators around with them, and they'd beep at each other between classes, and no one else could understand them. So she inspired a lot of hams that way with the that kit. I still have one of those laying around.
Yeah.
But it's very similar to that Altoids kit, only with more modern components and the touch sensor.
All right. Well,
it's a great little kit.
You know, we're going to be able to put this tracker together now. I'm going to package it up. I'm going to test it for a few more days. And, Bill, I need you to help me figure out when a good weather day is. I want a weather day that we don't have all these loops.
Until all our hurricanes are
past us. Yeah, I want some good weather, man, for this next flight. Yeah, because we want to set a record on this next one.
Well, one of my Pico balloon friends says to basically fly in months that contain an R in it for best success.
Well, yeah, I guess those are probably much better weather months than the others.
October through April are probably your best.
Yeah.
I was going to say, out till May is your next launch window.
Well, I'm not going to wait that long. We need to launch here soon. We need to launch soon, as soon as the hurricanes get out of here. And then if it goes down, we'll just launch another one right behind it. Let's just keep them going. So let me tell everybody about what this one's going to kind of look like. Went over last week. It's going to be we're going to use 10 of the little glass cells. They're very, very, man, those things are so fragile. Like you mentioned, Bill, if you sneeze, they'll break. So, I'm not even going to glue those down. I've done measurements with glue and adhesive. I mean, enough adhesive just to spot those things down will add 2 grams to the payload. So I'm going to have Kathy sew them in with some nylon thread, so they will be sewed in. And, of course, you know, our battery's going to be mounted down in it. There's the tracker, of course. And it's all going to be put on here. The solar panels will be put on top. And, you know, just the power system, and this tracker was flown or designed by Edward, and he didn't even fly a supercapacitor with it. He used six cells hooked directly to the tracker. And those 6 cells will give you right at 3 volts. Now, the tracker, that's getting pretty close to the top end of the tracker. I imagine 3.6 volts is probably your max on that tracker without destroying it. So he runs it straight without a supercapacitor for weight. He's all about weight, so he wants to fly his entire payload for about 6 or 8 grams. Ours is going to be a little bit more than that. So when we've flown this configuration, we've added a supercap in there. The supercap weighs about 2.2 grams, and you can tack it on there, and that'll help smooth out the fluctuations. If the sun or the cells turn, it'll keep your voltage up, and it'll also give you some extra current when you need it. But lately, this last one we flew, and we're going to try it again this time. We're going with 10 cells. 10 cells will give us a little over 5 volts. And, boy, these little things put out some power. There's a quarter of an amp of current that will come out of those 10 little glass cells. And the 4.2 regulator, that's what I was waiting on all the last week or two. I had some, but when I opened them up, they were 1.9-volt regulators. They were marked wrong, and people sold me the wrong ones. So I kept trying them, and I kept getting results of 1.9 volts, and I said, something's wrong, and I found out they were the wrong regulators. So what we're going to do, we're taking a 4.2-volt regulator per Bill's suggestion, and I was going to put one of those little bitty boards in there, the little lipo-charging board, but like Bill explained, the maximum voltage on that battery is 4.2 volts, and the solar panels are going to actually limit your charge. So the last balloon we launched, it seemed to work pretty well with just a 4.2 regulator charging a LiPo battery. Now, the LiPo battery in the last one we launched, it was 630 milliamp hours, and it was about 13 grams, a very, very heavy battery. This one, this battery here is only 5 grams total, and if we don't put a supercapacitor in, the supercap was about 2.4 grams, so if we take it out and just put that in, we're not gaining too much extra weight. So the battery is going to charge up to about 4.2 volts. The tracker, man, you get about 3.5 or 3.6, it's going to burn it up. So then we have to use another 3.3-volt regulator to come into to the tracker. So that's kind of our power system right there. Now, Bill, I had planned on using this, and I'll show it to you on this one, but we're going to go with the 5-gram battery. So I ordered some of these. These are 80 milliamp hour batteries. You can see they're really small, and they weigh 1 gram, Bill, 1 gram. So I'm thinking, why wouldn't I always use an 80 milliamp battery in place, a 1 gram battery in place of a 2.2 gram SuperCap. Why wouldn't I use this? This would even be lighter. What do you think, Bill? Stop using SuperCaps. Stop using SuperCaps.
You proved with the last flight that the battery, although it freezes out at night, it came back during the day. I would like to see a long duration test of a battery, though, to see how it handle a few weeks worth of cycling, whether it would still survive that. That's the big question, the unknown right now.
So I'm just wondering, if this little 1 gram battery would function just at minimum like a little super cap. You know, super caps are going to only give you a little, hold you a little charge for seconds. So I'm just wondering if this battery at altitude, this battery will work as a super cap, or if it's just too cold and it just won't work at all. That's my question.
Well,
you know, you're just going to have to rig up an ice box simulator at your house.
Well, we did that. We did that.
We got one.
We did that with the last battery, and we took it down to a minus 70, and it quit working. Well, I actually, it quit charging. So I'm not sure if it still had any output to it, but it quit charging at that temperature.
Yeah, you'd need to do a discharge analysis on it to see what it can do.
Yeah, we may do that. We may get our little box out and bring a temperature down again to that and just try it. But anyway, I'm thinking, okay, hey, this little battery right here weighs half of what my super cap weighs, so, you know, if this thing will work, this even gives you an advantage, not only acting as a super cap, but an 80 milliamp with the tracker drawing about 50 milliamps. You know, this already gives you about an hour in the dark, or maybe an hour if you're coming down in a storm. It might transmit, you know, in a dark cloud. I don't know. It's all experimental and all fun, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, those nuclear batteries are starting to make a lot of noise in the news these days. They're made from a little bit of radioactive waste.
Well,
they got a half-life of 20 years.
Yeah, I was talking to my friend. He's in the chat room, Mark Pupo, and he was telling about that little chip. Looked like a 14-pin dip chip that was the nuclear battery. And he says basically what's in here, you got the, I don't know, trinium or whatever glowing, and you got little solar cells in there that pick it up. So maybe that's how they build them. I don't know.
Yeah. I was just, it looks like a 14-pin dip. I couldn't find anything on a output current or, you know, power output on them.
Very, very low output current.
Yeah.
But it was talking about that it
could charge iPhone. You are the only participant in the conference.
We're the only participant.
The one that I've seen is in the chip, and it's several hundred dollars for the thing.
Oh, it was over $1,000 for it.
But it was saying it could charge an iPhone in 4 hours, and I'm like,
it was,
seriously? But I couldn't find any specs on the actual current.
Phone lines are open. Hey, if you're out there listening on shortwave, get a pencil. I'll give you the phone number in a minute. Call in and talk to us. And there's our phone number for everybody watching. And don't forget, you got to put the secret code in to get through to us. Well, we got to get these hurricanes out of the way, and then we'll go for another launch pretty soon.
Yeah, I think this is the first time, and I think they said in 15,000 years or something, that they've had two hurricanes that could possibly merge or orbit each other or come together.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think the Fujihara effect or something, that they could orbit each other if they're within 900 miles. They could either magnify or cancel out each other's strength. It's just a matter of roll the dice.
One thing I've noticed running UHF and VHF tropo DXing, about 2 days before a hurricane is about to arrive, if it's about 1,000 miles or so away from you, often there'll be a great tropospheric ducting event going on. So it's always a good time. There are benefits to a nearby hurricane as long as it doesn't actually hit you.
fortunately, I'm far enough inland that they generally have pretty much washed out and are nothing but rain and wind by the time they get here, but nothing really damaging.
We had hurricane force winds from Katrina, and we're 300 miles inland, and it was pretty pretty rough here. The windows were whistling.
Yeah, I remember that. It was the same way over here.
You know, that reminds me of the story. I've got, when I before I retired, I had techs working for me in, you know, many different places, and one place was Puerto Rico, and had a funny guy down there, funny tech down there, and he had just remodeled his house and put this great big old glass window in, man. It must have been, you know, 6 foot or 8 foot wide, and a big hurricane came up down there, and he said the glass was just bowing. It was just bowing. And he was standing there holding it, and his wife was telling him, you know, get back, you know. Anyway, the window didn't break. It stayed there. And I've never been in a hurricane. I've been in places like Miami, you know, the week before or week after, but I have been in a typhoon. Now, that was overseas, but I was in a typhoon once, and they had us sandbagging the doors, actually. Now, I never really understood why we want to sandbag the doors. We were up on a hill 400 feet high. We were sandbagging the doors there. I don't remember the weather getting very bad at all. Somebody asked in the chat room, how did we get down to minus 70? We built a insulated box, and we put dry ice in there. The temperature of dry ice is about minus 70. And we had some nice measuring equipment that would measure Celsius or Fahrenheit, and with a probe that connects to a meter we have, and we were able to put that probe down in the box with the battery. So that's how we did it. Someday, somebody will invent a battery that will work that cold right now. There's just not much out there.
Well, Tom will say 73 is from here in Nebraska.
Thanks, Joe, for being with us and sharing some new kits with us, man.
You bet. It's
always
a
pleasure.
Joe, I have to say, I'm really impressed by that the Marcerino?
Yeah.
The fact that all that technology to be able to send Morse code via the internet to another person anywhere in the world is just phenomenal, but still Morse code in each end. So Morse code still rules.
Definitely. And
I
said, I'll get it going when I get that other part back so I can get the display back up, and I'll show it with the display running.
All right. Well, hey, they're asking again, what was his secret? Well, the secret was your clock back there. Your clock back there came out of sack?
The doomsday clock.
That's the doomsday clock. That's the actual
nuclear.
That's the actual doomsday clock that came out of wherever. Where was it? Down in a mountain or somewhere?
Nope. Off at Air Force Base.
Oh, off at Air Force. Okay. Well, I want the one.
In that case, yeah, we're in big trouble because now it's two hours past midnight.
But, you know, here's the thing. They have now outsourced the doomsday clock to Joe, so now he's in charge of it.
Well, I'm a little disappointed being a taxpayer that I didn't get dibs on that clock, too. So I don't know, man. I mean, we're going to have to challenge that somewhere.
Well, it's definitely all right. A conversation piece.
All right, Joe. Thanks so much, man. We'll see you in a few weeks. Get some more kits.
But, you know, you were talking about Morse code. That was actually one of the things in my first book that surprised me. Next to the lightning detector, the random CW generator project was actually one of the most popular projects in that whole book.
I built that.
See?
Yeah, I built that, and it was pretty nice. Also, you know, I built one of the CW decoders with Arduino, and it didn't have but about three parts in it. I mean, it had almost nothing in it. It was not the one that you had in your book. You know,
right.
I think the one in your book.
Mine was hardware-based. Yours was firmware-based.
Yeah, the one in your book, I think you had a chip, but like a 567 or something?
Yeah, I used the old 567 to decode the tone.
Yeah. Well, this one basically, man, it was all done in the code, and it had a single coupling capacitor basically to your audio, and it worked fairly good. So it's just amazing what you can do with these projects, these Arduino projects. In fact, I guess, Bill, are we running?
When I was in high school, I was sick for a few days, and I could not for the life of me get any faster than about 8 or 9 words a minute. So I spent 3 days in my room listening to my great uncle, W-A-U-N, and he was talking to his friend in Florida, who would not slow down for anybody. They were probably sending about 20 words a minute, my uncle was, but his friend in Florida, he was sending at 33 words a minute, and he wouldn't slow down. He said, if you couldn't keep up, you know, he's not slowing down for you. So I made it my goal to get up to 33 words a minute so I could copy his conversations. And after 3 days of listening to Morse code solidly, I was able to achieve it. So I sent back a message to him at 33 words a minute, which I did on a straight key. You had to get it real close together and just kind of breathe on it, and they could make contact. But you can send over 30 words a minute on a straight key. So I sent to him at 33 words a minute. He said, slow down.
Yeah.
So, you know, he could dish it out, but he couldn't take it.
Right.
But, you know, when I built that project, that's actually, you know, I had to test it, and I had it sitting on the table behind me while I was working on something else. And lo and behold, I noticed over just the course of a weekend, my code speed pretty much came up from probably 8 or 9 words a minute up to 13, 14 just over that weekend by having it playing in the background.
Well, my favorite mode in Field Day is CW. That's my job when I go out to different events. I'd love it. So those of you who, even though it's not required, it is one of the real joys of ham radio to be able to actually hear the characters in your mind as you're tuning across the band.
Well, you know, I'm not a real CW person now. I'm mostly voice, and you know, got my license 50 years ago. But, you know, I can still do fair on CW. I mean, it's like riding a bicycle. I guess you don't forget it. I mean, I'm not, you know, I've got an extra license. I'm probably good at 13 words a minute now, not 20, but, you know, I was able to do 20. But,
I mentioned it on a previous show that some movies and even cartoons embed secret messages in Morse code in them.
Yeah.
And I watched a Porky Pig cartoon once, and it said, and it showed Porky Pig sending a message on the telegraph, the bridge is out, the bridge is out. But it really said, if you could copy this, send for your free Looney Tunes picture.
Yeah.
P.O.
Yeah.
Box 37, Hollywood, California. There's no zip code.
Well, I think I got the free decoder. I got the free decoder ring.
Yeah, when I got it back, I did get a picture back, and it said that message was put in there in 1937.
Well, that's one of the reasons I did the keyboard. I can type faster than I can send on a straight key. So I built the CW key that I could type on.
Yeah, I built the CW keyer with the keyboard. I think you had a PS2 keyboard, didn't it?
Right. I'm actually revisiting that, and I'm trying to do it with a Bluetooth.
Oh, really? What about just a regular keyboard without, not a PS2, but, well that's a USB. Would it be hard to do it for a USB keyboard?
I am working on that as well. It's kind of a parallel project.
Yeah.
The problem with the USB is you need a lot of smarts to understand the various USB devices these days. Once they went up to USB 2.0, there's a lot of smarts in the protocol that the Arduino just is not really capable of picking up without the host shield. You can't do it like the PS2 and just grab the data line.
Well, I'm sure you can still find PS2. I'm sure you can find surplus PS2 keyboards everywhere, man, especially on eBay.
Yeah, you can't get them anymore. That's why I'm revisiting this, and I've actually got a little folding Bluetooth keyboard for your, you know, smartphone. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking to tie that into the Arduino, and so you could use one of those little small Bluetooth-type keyboards. But failing that, yeah, I'm looking at doing it with USB as well.
Well, someday you'll be able to figure it out where you can just think and transmit it in Morse code. Won't that be kind of cool?
Well, when they get the vaccine for COVID-19 and you get implanted with the chip, that's how they'll implement all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll start updating your firmware wirelessly, and then you can do that.
We're talking about some weird things, aren't we?
Hey, I'm here.
Have you you remember the story about a guy picking up a radio station because of the filling in his tooth? You ever heard that story?
Lucy Arnaz.
Oh, was it?
Claimed that they never really could prove it or disprove it.
Because she was the only one that could hear it.
She had just had some dental work and claimed that she was able to pick up one of the AM stations.
Why? Well, I guess it's possible.
Oh, I think it is. You know, back in that day, you know, the fillings were metal.
Yeah.
And it'd be very easy to get the diode effect out of dissimilar metals and whatnot.
Yeah.
And my first receiver was a cat's whisker crystal radio with a big coil.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's no different than a filling in your tooth, you know.
You know, so... I mean, it's very possible, but they all said it wasn't possible, and I'm like,
You know what? I have neglected the phone call. I hadn't looked over here, and it's been turned down. We got somebody on the phone. How you doing? How you doing on the phone?
You probably see me as.
I see you as David.
Yeah, you probably see me as David, also known as Russ. KG0BK.
Yeah. Well, hey, man, how long have you been holding? I'm sorry, I didn't even look over here. We might have had a bunch of calls drop.
Oh, it's only been about 5-6 minutes.
Okay, cool, man. But, we're into discussing picking up radio signals with the filling in your teeth now. You want to jump on that?
Yeah, I got into most of that. That all came over the phone, and I guess Joe left. Well, I want to say hi to Bill and Glenn, and of course you. My mentor was a Navy radio operator, and during World War II, and we'd be sitting there talking, and he'd have his HF rig turned down kind of low, but he'd be getting some signals. Oh, just a minute, he just called me. What? And they're going, blah, 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 blah. I was, I think, at 10 words a minute at the time, but he could be talking to me, and he would know that they called him, and he would call them back. But the thing is, I called, I found out what was wrong with the last balloon. It never dawned on me until just right after it went down. Usually it was sent up 3 amps. This time only 2 amps. So one's looking out forward. He says, we're going forward. The other one's looking out backward. He says, we're going backwards. Well, the third ant could have been in there and says, no, we're going around in circles, and they could have corrected that problem.
Well, that's a good theory. But, you know, with the new computer automation we had on board this time, it eliminated the need for a third crew member. So we'll just have to make sure.
Yeah,
we'll
I think we need to set up that third ant. He's just going to have to lose a little bit of weight if you're going to add.
Yeah, I just want to say the weight, we could either have the battery or the amp, so the battery was the choice this time.
All right, well, we're talking about, in the last couple minutes, we talked about filling and teeth and stuff, and what, who was that, Lucy Arnaz? Was that Lucy?
It was Lucy Ball.
Oh, yeah, Lucy. Okay, well, here's another trivia thing. This movie star back about then basically invented the technology for a cell phone. You know who that was?
Oh, Wasn't it Hedy Lamarr?
Yeah, I think Hedy Lamarr. She actually was the one that figured out the scheme of the radio signals that nowadays can be used for cell phones. And I don't know how she did that. I don't know if she was a technical person or what back then.
Yeah, apparently she was very,
well, she was a handler, right?
Oh, was she? I don't know. I don't know.
I believe so. I can't tell you her call sign, but I believe she was a ham.
Well, that may be. You know, a lot of things have come out of ham radio. I think possibly it may have not been the triggering factor, but I think in the early days there was even experimentation by ham radio operators with the early TV days. I don't know how much that played a part in TV.
A lot of the hams developed the technology they used because we were given the bands that nobody else wanted because they said they were useless.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how we
got
20
people. Tom. You guys take care.
Russ, we're going to call the show off here in just a minute. We've been going an hour and a half, so we'll probably end the show. But thanks for calling, man. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Oh, and I sent some more money to you for another balloon.
Man.
If one stays up, goes around the world, I'll double it next time.
Oh, man. Well, this is going to make it. Get your wallet ready, but you don't have to do that, man. Thank you. Thank you so much, man.
Oh, hey, it's wonderful. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Hey, Tom.
Uh-huh.
In the chat room, where they were talking about movie stars and TV stars and ham radio, and they said there was an episode of the Munsters where Herman Munster gets on the ham radio, and
yeah,
his call sign in that episode was W6XRL4.
Yeah, and you know what? I've watched, I think on YouTube, you can actually pull that part of that show up on YouTube and watch it, yeah.
But actually, that call is active on QRZ.com.
Is that right?
Yes.
All right.
And actually, what was it? The series Jericho was about 7, 8 years, 10 years back. Every episode opened with a CW message.
Oh, yeah. All right, guys, look, we've been on long enough tonight. Thanks for everybody showing up, and thanks for everybody tuning in tonight and joining us on the show. And we will see you next week. 73 to everybody.
Night.
So you're saying I can ask this cat any question?
The cat is connected to the computer. You just type in the questions, and it will read his mind.
I'm gonna do that.
You're the man! I've been looking for this for weeks.
That's the scary part is, you know, we're in the era when that movie was set for its future.
Yeah, they kind of have a hoverboard, but it requires a solid sheet of metal and big electromagnets.
Well, what are you
actually,
guys talking about?
They're getting the flying car.